I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In Damascus, Syria, the United Nations has closed its offices after a shootout and bombing in the diplomatic quarter last night. The U.S. and British embassies have also temporarily closed. The attack comes a week after an incident in neighboring Jordan, where alleged terrorists were captured in a raid and shootout that Jordanian officials say thwarted a major terrorist attack there. Mariam Karouni is a correspondent for Reuters. She joins us on the line from Damascus. Mariam, you went to the site of last night's attacks. What do we know happened?
What we know, Robin, is that the security forces in Syria, they battled with about four gunmen yesterday in Mezze, which is a diplomatic quarter where many foreign embassies are located. And then the Syrian authorities said that these gunmen, they set off a bomb, a car bomb, and then they battled them and they killed two assailants, while a policeman was killed and a woman bystander as well.
We're hearing two versions of the story. One, that the gunman pulled up and started shooting. Another, that the gunman might have been chased and maybe cornered and then got out and began shooting. Do you know?
What people said here, what witnesses said here, is that these people came out from a white van, and started shooting at the building, which used to be the house of UN. And then the Syrian security forces came, and then the battle started. That's what witnesses told us, actually.
The government has also said that they found a weapons cache overnight. Do they have any sense of who these four gunmen were?
Actually, there's nothing about the nationalities and who are these people. The Syrian authorities have said nothing about it, but they promised that as soon as they finish investigating, they will announce it. Mm-hmm. And they promised that, between quotes, they are going to be really honest with people, especially with the Syrians.
Well, Syria is...
We have contacted many diplomats, and they all said that they have no idea who are these people and what they were targeting. They said also that it's only the Syrian authorities that are giving them the information. So it's the only source of information now are the Syrian authorities.
Mariam, recently Jordan officials say that they thwarted a terrorist attack and that one of those alleged terrorists was from Syria. Is there any sense of that these two events, or the non-event in Jordan and the event in Syria, are linked?
Actually, it could be possible. But others believe that few people here believe that Jordan's announcement has alerted the Syrian authority. It could have alerted the Syrian authority, and that's why they were fast in dealing with this situation and preventing it from spreading to other parts or areas in Damascus.
Mariam, tell us one last thing. How are the people in Damascus reacting to this violence? It's rather unusual for Syria, isn't it?
Yes, actually, people here in Damascus were really shocked with and they couldn't believe that it is happening in their own capital. And few of them blamed Islamists, while others also blamed the U.S. because they said the U.S. is provoking these people, is provoking Islamic radicals in Syria to attack foreign interests so that it weakens Syria from inside.
Well, Mariam, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Mariam Karouni is correspondent for Reuters. She spoke to us from Damascus, Syria.
India, the world's largest democracy, in which there are 600 million eligible voters, is holding an election. It's a mammoth undertaking, presently taking place over 3 weeks in five phases. And this time around, it's also a vote almost completely computerized, even more so than any election ever held in the United States. Joining us from New Delhi to talk about the Indian elections is reporter Veer Singh. Welcome, Veer.
Hello.
Some wonderful contrasts always in India in this case of the election. It's almost fully computerized, this election, and yet we hear of computer machines having to be hauled around the country by beasts of burden.
Well, you've seen a certain level of economic development. You see great interstates, snaking across the countryside. But You also have regions of India which are very hard to access, such as in the northeast, in the state of Assam, in the hilly states around it. You see election machines, something that symbolizes the 21st century being carried on an elephant, the occasional camel, yes. But you also then have helicopters, and it just goes to show that some parts of India are indeed very hard to reach by land, and so they have to fly them in, or if there's no road, then yes, they have to resort to beasts of burden.
Now, who's running against who for prime minister?
India is currently has a coalition government, which is headed by the BJP, which is headed by Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee. Now, he has a coalition and several allies that have a comfortable majority in the national parliament. They were widely predicted to win by a wide margin. That margin is now being called into question by certain exit polls, which has caused a great stir and some amount of elation in the opposition camp. However, the opposition are not seen to have a great chance of forming a government. Currently, exit polls point to a hung parliament, and that indecision is causing jitters in the financial markets.
Well, speaking of financial markets, Prime Minister Vajpayee is presiding over an economy that's roaring at 8% growth. Why wouldn't that be a ticket to a big victory for him?
You see evidence of this growth in certain urban centers, such as a part of South Delhi, the national capital, where a lot of computer firms have set up shop. A lot of the outsourcing of jobs you see coming to urban centers. This growth that we read about has not been equitably distributed. There are large pockets of poverty, large places in India where things have not changed, where people have not seen their incomes rise. This is causing some frustration. So you really see local issues, people who live in places that have very poor or almost no supplies of electricity, water, sanitation. They simply want to give the other party, the other candidate, a chance.
Veer, how free of violence has this election been so far?
Well, if you go by a very crude body count, you see the number. There's been about 39 people reported killed in this election so far, which is halfway through, compared with 100 people killed in all of the election last time around. So violence has been scattered and not something that has characterized either the election campaign or the election itself.
And Veer, how free of fraud has this election been, this highly computerized election?
It should be noted that electronic voting machines have more to do with efficiency and counting of votes rather than doing away with fraud. So that whereas earlier you had ballot boxes stuffed with fake and really unrepresentative votes, this time you have some accounts, especially in the state of Bihar, which voted yesterday, of party workers showing up in large numbers, intimidating the election and security officials on duty, and simply pressing this button on the electronic voting machine again and again and again. It should be said that this is not something that characterizes the conduct of elections. You do see it, but it's not something that we see that is all prevalent.
Reporter Veer Singh joined us from New Delhi, India. Veer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For the first time ever, the International Olympic Committee has taken out an insurance policy on the Games and plans to make this precedent for all future Games. The $170 million policy will cover losses should the Games in Athens this summer have to be canceled because of a natural disaster or because of terrorism. Joining us on the line from Greece is Chief Athens Correspondent for Reuters, Brian Williams. Welcome, Brian.
Hello, Bill, and good to talk again.
Brian, there have been a lot of delays with construction and so on, and worries that the Games might not even be ready this August. Does that have anything to do with why the IOC took out insurance?
No. It was very specifically for earthquake, for war, and for terrorism. And it's something that has been considered well before this. I mean, the IOC first started talking about it actually before the Salt Lake Games, and they had intended to take insurance out to Salt Lake. But when September 11 happened, no insurance company would touch them. Now, memories seem as though they've faded a little bit now, so they can get insurance.
Yeah, I think that's what surprised a lot of us, that they could even get insurance for this sort of thing. Who'd they get it from?
Well, what our understanding is, it's from a group of leading European insurers. There's a consortium of them. They've spread the risk, if you like. But our understanding is that they're European insurers.
Now, Brian, God forbid the Olympics were canceled and this policy had to be paid out. What impact would that have on insurance worldwide?
Well, I think to put it in perspective, frankly, $170 million in insurance terms is a drop in the ocean. I mean, if you look at the World Trade Center payout, it's likely to be $40 billion. Mm. So $170 million is really something these big insurance companies could handle very, very easily.
Does say something about the times we live in, though, that they would need a policy at all, doesn't it?
Yes, well, I think I could say fairly that the Athens Games people, given all the negative publicity, et cetera, they've had, you know, the slow pace of preparations, that they were not terribly pleased that the IOC, took the action, but the timing of it did not go down very well here.
Let's change the subject just for the minute or so we have left. We've been following the progress of the roof being put on the Olympic Dome. Yesterday was supposed to be the deadline to get that done, to get two huge arches swung into place so the roof could be built in time. What's the status?
Well, this is hot off the presses, as they say. I've just spoken to one of the leading Olympic people here. The new deadline, the new deadline, is May the 21st. And what they are hoping is that they'll start sliding the roof this weekend.
Hmm. Okay. Well, we were told by a correspondent yesterday and many reports that if they didn't get it done yesterday, it wouldn't get done. But I guess, as before, the deadline's slid again, huh?
That's right. I mean, what they're saying is that they've done a lot of work on the ground in the sense of attaching things to the roof. You know, there'll be security cameras, there'll be actual television camera type apparatus attached to the roof itself. Now, that work was going to be done once the roof was up, but what they've worked out now is they've done a lot of that work on the ground, which they say gives them the leeway to now have this new deadline of May the 21st.
Brian Williams is chief Athens correspondent for Reuters. He joined us from Athens. Brian, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
Just ahead, we speak with the Minister of the Environment for the European Union on setting European standards over the objections of U.S. officials.
And later, the Supreme Court hears arguments in the enemy non-combatant case of Jose Padilla and Yasser Hamdi.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Much has been made of the differences between the United States and the European Union when it comes to environmental policy. Differences on climate change and the Kyoto Protocol. Differences on genetically modified crops, on fuel efficiency standards, and on lesser-known issues such as testing industrial chemicals for safety. That last one is a battle Margot Wallström has been fighting against fierce lobbying from the chemical industry and the Bush administration. Wallström is the European Union Commissioner for the Environment, and she joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. Tell us about this chemical testing proposal. It's called the REACH program. First of all, what was the need for it, and what was it supposed to do?
To improve the level of environmental protection and health protection, because we know too little of the chemicals that are used in our daily lives. Today's system and policy on chemicals do not offer the high level of protection that we would like.
We understand that there's a rise in allergies and in other illnesses in Europe, and it was thought that they might be attached to these chemicals?
That's correct. We have an increasing incidence of cancers, allergies, asthma, a lot of different diseases that we think are linked to the use of chemicals.
And what had you wanted to test?
Well, of course, we think that most of these chemicals that we use in our daily lives are harmless. But there are some that we know that their inherent properties are very hazardous. And we want to see these either phased out or substituted by less harmful ones, or at least that we know about the risks and that we can manage those risks. But also those who are produced in high volumes and where we see clearly that they carry some risks, we would like to do more of testing so that we can say that they are user safe.
How has the Bush administration and the chemical industry responded to the initial proposal?
Well, if we make a new legislation in Europe, we cannot discriminate between the chemicals produced in Europe or those that we import. So, of course, the same rules will have to apply for everybody. So we've seen quite some lobbying activities on this specific issue.
In fact, both the Bush administration and the chemical industry have said publicly that the EU proposal would threaten the $20 billion in chemicals the U.S. exports to Europe, that it would switch the burden from government testing to company testing. And a House committee in the U.S. found in early April that the Bush administration had been working very hard with the chemical company behind the scenes, lobbying against it. And some of the critics of the EU proposal, greenies, if you will, say that it's been hopelessly watered down because of the lobbying.
No, I don't think that is correct. I mean, we've seen a lot of lobbying. That is absolutely true. Of course, we were a bit surprised that it was so planned, well planned and carried out, the U.S. lobbying, I must say. But I think that the basic elements of this proposal, in which we want to close this knowledge gap, we want to reverse the burden of proof and improve the information throughout the chain of users of chemicals, I think those basic elements are still there and we can defend it. So it's a good and balanced proposal still.
One email that was found by the House committee investigating this was written from commerce officials in the U.S. to the chemical industry, urging them to get to the Swedes and the Finns and neutralize their positions. Aren't you a Swede?
Yes, I'm a Swede. And I guess that I'm existing in this whole game as a voodoo doll in some of the companies' boardrooms. I don't know. But I think that if we can get rid of some of the exaggerations around our proposal and really also inform the U.S. citizens about it, and including the U.S. industry, we will be much better off.
Well, moving to the broader environmental issues, how far apart, really, do you think the U.S. and Europe are on environmental issues?
I think on most environmental issues we can cooperate. I think that what we've been worried about has to do with the U.S. position towards a multilateral approach, for example, on climate change and also on some other specific issues. And we are also working together on where we can find ground for cooperation.
And yet the Bush administration decided not to sign the Kyoto Protocol on climate change. But even the EU Commissioner for Transport and Energy recently suggested that the Kyoto Plan poses a severe threat to European industry. What was your reaction to that?
I haven't heard her say that. I wouldn't say that. I mean, even if there is one or two voices who express concern, this doesn't mean that there is any sort of gap or differences in our approach.
Well, that's interesting, because according to the Financial Times last February, her comments were said to cause a rift between the two of you. They were seen as being more supportive of the industry, seen as taking a break with the Commission's stand.
Well, on that, I think that she was interested in maybe already now start a debate about what happens if Russia doesn't ratify things.
In fact, how many European nations are expected to make their Kyoto targets for emissions reductions?
Well, I expect all of them to do so. It will not be easy, but we will help them, and I think that emissions trading will help them to do it in a cost-efficient way.
Well, in fact, one theory that's being discussed in the U.S. is that American companies are losing a competitive edge economically right now, because while European companies are updating technology and at least trying to comply with Kyoto, U.S. companies are not. So the thinking is that when companies can't do anything but comply. In other words, at a time when they're forced to comply, when there isn't another option, that U.S. companies will be left behind.
But exactly. And you wouldn't believe how many American businesses that are actually taking contact with the European Union to ask about our emissions trading system, whether it would be made compatible with any American future system. And that is also what I've seen now in visiting some of the northeastern states, where they have a voluntary system working together, several states and also with the Canadian provinces, to establish a system of emissions trading and getting greenhouse gas emissions down. So this is already happening at state level and at local and regional level. So that is where we are looking for cooperation with the United States.
Margot Wahlstrom, thank you.
Thank you.
Margot Wahlstrom is the European Union Commissioner for the Environment.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, as the EU expands, we ask, how big is too big?
And President Bush and Vice President Cheney appear together behind closed doors before the 9/11 Commission. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The U.S. Supreme Court heard a landmark case this morning in which justices were asked whether the President of the United States should have the power to hold U.S. citizens indefinitely without charge in wartime. U.S. citizens Jose Padilla and Yasser Hamdi have both been designated enemy combatants by President Bush. They've been held for about 2 years in military jails, not formally charged with anything under U.S. law. Padilla was picked up in Chicago, suspected of plotting with al-Qaeda to explode a radioactive dirty bomb. Hamdi was taken into custody in Afghanistan, fighting with the Taliban. Scott Silliman is executive director of the Duke University Law School Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security. He listened to this morning's proceedings. Welcome, Professor Silliman.
Good afternoon, Bill.
Thanks for joining us. Tell us what the court heard this morning. This was not about the guilt or innocence of these two men, right? Because they haven't been charged with anything.
You're exactly correct, Bill. The whole question before the Supreme Court in first the Hamdi case and then after that the Padilla case were argued. And the issue is, what is the role of our federal courts in reviewing the detention by the President of the United States as Commander-in-Chief of American citizens without affording them access to a lawyer or without ever charging them? And that's the central question, which was before the court today in both cases.
As you say, the cases were heard back to back, not together. Tell us as concisely as you can about what arguments were made on their behalf and prosecuting them.
Bill, the Hamdi case and Mr. Dunham, who's his attorney, who argued on his behalf, were basically suggesting that there has been absolutely no opportunity for Hamdi to have any say or to challenge the facts that the president set forth in what's called the Mobbs Declaration. And the Fourth Circuit, when it heard and issued its opinion in the Hamdi case, basically said that all that the federal courts can and should do is look in a very marginal way at what the government says are the facts justifying that detention. Now, the difference is, of course, Hamdi was picked up on the battlefield, as you suggested just a minute ago. Padilla was picked up at Chicago O'Hare Airport, was never in the hands of the military until they took him out of New York. So to some extent, the Padilla case is a much more difficult one for the government to argue, and I think we saw that in the argument this morning.
Now, has this sort of thing been argued before the Supreme Court before? How landmark is this case?
This is a significant case, Bill, simply because the only precedents of the court go all the way back to World War II, and the cases were mentioned this morning in oral argument. The Kieran case involving German saboteurs in 1942, one of which claimed to be an American citizen. Torito case, an American citizen captured in Sicily and made to be a prisoner of war. But these cases come out of a declared war situation, totally different from this war on terrorism that we're now in. And the justices, I think, were very troubled with the fact that the government argues that it can maintain an American citizen in detention for basically an unlimited period of time. And I think the justices' questions indicated they were looking for some type of review mechanism. It might be military, it might be a little greater in the federal courts, but some review mechanism if Congress doesn't step in and legislate in this area.
Let me ask you very briefly, Professor, could this open up the question of holding enemy combatants without charge who are not U.S. citizens?
Well, no, that's pretty much decided, Bill. And, of course, that's the issue that we heard last week before the Supreme Court in the Roswell v. Bush Guantanamo Bay cases. That's the issue for that particular case that was heard. The American citizen and their rights under the Constitution is the pivotal question that was argued this morning. And to that extent, it's a far more significant case for the government as far as whether it will continue to have the same tools in this war on terrorism that it has maintained it has now.
Scott Silliman is executive director of the Duke University Law School Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, Bill.
The U.S. Supreme Court heard apologies for that. Most states are in deep financial trouble, right? Well, that's certainly been the case for the past few years. But according to a new study by the National Conference of State Legislatures, state economies are now dramatically improving, which is the good news. The bad news may be the price being paid for better bottom lines. Joining us on the line is Gene Rose, Director of Public Affairs for the National Conference. Gene, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Gene, we've heard a lot about states being in big financial trouble. But what are the findings of the study of the National Conference of State Legislatures?
Well, what we found is that the red ink for states is finally turning black. Budgets that states had under stress for the last 3 years are finally seeing some relief.
Well, before we get to some reasons why, give me some numbers. How dramatic is the turnaround?
Just a year ago, we were looking at a $78.4 billion budget gap for states. And states are required to balance their budgets every year. In contrast, this year the budget gap that we noticed in our latest report is only $720 million in just a select few states.
Wow. What happened?
Well, the economy definitely has turned around, but state legislatures were kind of put under the gun here in the last 3 years and had to come up with some creative ways to meet these budget gaps and had to take a hard look at their policies and the programs that they had to fund.
Well, as we know, unlike the federal government, states are required to balance their budgets. But I still ask, as the economy has turned around, as certainly can be argued from some numbers in the economy, though if you're unemployed at the moment, maybe it doesn't feel that way. How has that made it possible for states to go from red to black ink?
State legislatures had to make some difficult decisions. A number of states' Medicaid rolls had to be cut back. Fees and other things were increased in different areas of the country.
Taxes?
You know, the remarkable thing about meeting these budget gaps over the last 3 years is that states really have met these budget gaps without without any broad-based tax increases.
Huh.
I think there's definitely been a cry from the public that that they want some fiscal relief for themselves. So the states have had to look at creative ways to try to meet those budget gaps.
Does that mean cutting programs?
A lot of programs have been cut. Higher education, I think, has particularly been one area that has been hit pretty hard during the last 3 years, and you're seeing actually some states where the state legislatures are letting the universities do some of their own financing, or the universities had to raise student fees and things like that to meet their budgets.
So, Gene, if it's good news that budgets are being balanced, there's a price, isn't there?
There is a price that's being paid. That is correct. The best thing that can help budgets is a turnaround in the economy, and it does look like we're experiencing some of that right now, and that helps with revenue collections. The other thing during the 1990s, there were a lot of capital gains by investors, and the stock market was definitely helping out. And you're seeing the stock market rebounding a little bit. And those type of things all contribute to a healthy budget for states.
Just to finish up, Gene, is there any model here for the federal government, which, of course, is drowning in red ink?
Well, we certainly think that the balanced budget requirements that states have to live under definitely helps the states out. What you find in the states is that the state economies kind of often lag behind what the federal economy is doing. So while there have been certain things nationally that have required us to kind of dip into the federal reserves right now, we think that the balanced budget requirements are definitely a good thing.
Gene Rose is Director of Public Affairs for the National Conference of State Legislatures. Gene, thank you very much.
It's our pleasure.
Still to come, remembering the master choreographer George Balanchine on the 100th anniversary of his birth.
You're listening to Here and Now.
The British economy is booming. A steady growth coupled with low employment and inflation has Gordon Brown, Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, so pleased he exclaimed that other countries are now examining the new British model. But critics are saying, hold on, British consumers are borrowing like never before, and some economists are predicting a crash in the housing market over the next 5 years. Well, joining us from the studios of The Economist in London is Paul Wallace, British economy correspondent. And Paul, just tell us, which is it? We've got two very different snapshots here.
Well, on the one hand, the British economy is doing well, and Gordon Brown, you're right to say, is constantly telling people how well it's doing, how much better it's doing than European economies. And inflation is low and unemployment is low. But on the other hand, there is this big worry about the housing market, which has been bounding upwards, and people have been borrowing a lot. So there's this concern that if the housing market turns sour, people will end up with too much debt and with negative equity, in other words, owing more on their houses than the value of the houses.
And by the way, I misspoke. I said there was low employment. Of course, the good news is there's low unemployment, as you just said. But what are some of the other factors? I mean, is it just the housing that's causing concern, or are people using their credit cards elsewhere?
No, the increase in debt, which is rising at about 15% a year, which is very rapidly, is shared both across the secured debt, in other words, the mortgage borrowing, and also unsecured, you know, credit cards. So there's an awful lot of that going on.
What's driving it? What's the general good mood?
Oh, well, it's undoubtedly because inflation has come down. So the cost of borrowing seems rather low. And in fact, with the credit card loans, the cost of this borrowing has also fallen because lower credit quality borrowers are getting better deals. So there's a bit of a structural change there. But the main force behind the increase in debt is the fact that it's much cheaper, really, to finance it.
And is there a sense that, as some are saying in the U.S., now, debt is a good thing. It's a sign of confidence. It's not a burden. It's a challenge to the future. Is there economic psychology at play as well?
Yes and no. I suppose it is a sign of confidence. And of course, you know, from the perspective of an individual borrower, say borrowing against his house and the house is going up in value a lot, you know, he's better off. He's got more assets than debt. The worry is that the debt sticks around in a low inflation environment, and the assets on the other side of the balance sheet may fall quite a bit if the house price boom has turned into a speculative bubble.
Mm. Well, I was going to ask you about that, Paul. We're familiar with bubbles here on this side of the pond, and I'm wondering, is this a bubble that's going to burst? And in just the few seconds we have, how does that affect the rest of Europe's economy?
I think myself that the housing market will come down. Whether it'll come down with a bump or whether it'll just be a protracted period of very, very virtually stagnant prices, I cannot say at the moment. But on past form, it's more likely to be the former. In other words, it'll come down with a bump eventually. In terms of the impact on Europe, then the British economy would slow down if the housing market collapses. So that would be one of the main stimuluses to the European economy, which has been very stagnant, being removed.
Mm. Well, Paul Wallace, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Paul Wallace, British economy correspondent for The Economist.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
And now, this bulletin from your garden. If you're lucky enough to have one, now's the time to get into your garden and do some work to keep it healthy in the month to come. And our garden guru, Mike McGrath, host of Public Radio's You Bet Your Garden, joins us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia with what sounds like garden alerts, Mike.
Well, you talk about health and you talk about disease. I think the most disease-prone plant that we have in America today is the rose, only because many years ago, a wild Iranian rose was discovered, and it was bred into thousands of garden roses before somebody realized, wait a minute, this is a desert rose. It doesn't react well to moisture. And that's where all the black spot and rose diseases have come from. So rose growers, now's the time to go out and remove all the old mulch. That mulch is a giant daycare center. It's just thriving with germs right now, waiting to splash back up onto your roses. And if you don't have any mulch around your roses, scrape off the top quarter inch of soil. 1 inch of compost on top of the soil, as far around the rose as you expect the rose to grow outward, is the best preventative against disease. Compost prevents disease on all plants three different ways when you put it on the surface of the soil. It creates an environment that disease can't really thrive in. Some elements of compost compete for the same food as disease organisms. But my favorite are the thermophilic bacteria that are bred in a hot compost pile. They eat disease. That's their favorite food. So when spores blow in, they're landing on this mulch that has billions of little Pac-Men in it that are just waiting for them to drop down on top. So ain't nothing going to blow back up on your roses when it rains and the winds come.
Okay. We also have a second news item for us regarding pre-chilled bulbs. Now, this is a product people in warm climates, say Arizona, are familiar with, but not here in the East.
All the time in spring, people are always telling me, well, I forgot to plant my bulbs last fall. Can I plant them now? And if they're sprouting, the answer is yes, especially put them up in pots so you can get a good show. But this year, something that was really interesting that I hadn't seen before, Brex actually marketed pre-chilled bulbs to regular old gardeners in late winter so that if they didn't put them in the ground last fall, they could still have a spring bulb display anyway. They sent these bulbs that were already chilled and sprouting for them as if they had been in the ground all winter.
Kind of forced, yeah. Mike McGrath, host of Public Radio's You Bet Your Garden, and our garden news flash guy here on Here and Now. Mike, thanks.
Always a pleasure, Robin. Take care.
George Balanchine, the founding choreographer of the New York City Ballet, would have turned 100 this year, and ballet fans and companies around the world are paying tribute. Balanchine is credited with taking the classical ballet style of his native Russia and speeding it up and paring it down to reflect the style of America, his adopted country. Iris Fanger is co-curator of a new exhibit on Balanchine at Harvard University.
He was one of the greatest geniuses of the 20th century, but he was a pretty ordinary guy like the rest of us. And he loved to cook. He was legendary. We have a marvelous picture of him dressed up in his good suit with a Western tie, looking very proud at his Easter table. He would cook for days and days before Easter each year.
More on the Harvard exhibit in a moment. But first, Here and Now's Lynn Manigan spoke with former New York City ballet dancer Karin von Aroldingen about cooking with Mr. B.
He hated the word creation. He said, God creates. I'm a maker. I'm a ballet maker. And he was masterful in what he, his invention of ballets and the versatility of it. And it's all related to cooking.
What ties do you see between making ballets and cooking?
Well, it's physical. And the first thing that couldn't be described better when he said, I'm a chef in a restaurant. I have to provide food, you know, meaning steps. He would say to of his ballets that he said, this ballet is an appetizer, this is an entree, this is, dessert. His cooking was simple, but it was inventive. The way how, that was the difference, you know. Like the little meatballs he made, he called them kotletkis. And it's not, the ingredients are, you use, you know, either Zweibach or white bread, and you put cream in it, and then knead, the kneading of the meat is important, you know.
How long do you knead them for?
As long as you feel like it needs to be. It's as long as you're satisfied, you know.
As long as you and the meatballs need it.
That's what he would say, right? I think so. Finally, when he puts them perfectly in a wonderful shape, they were dancing. He made them dance, you know. And then he would cook, and he would constantly stir them so they would be puffy and sizzling. Reminded me of a violin concerto, he said, you know.
The ballet, Stravinsky violin concerto, your ballet.
Well, yeah, but it has a lot of character in the architecture of it and the folk in, and it's all reminded him. He and Stravinsky would always get together and just have a good time drinking and eating.
His cooking reflects so much about his personality and his way of approaching art.
How he cared about each item, how he worked in his kitchen looked like, it was like a stage set. He was like a master in his kitchen, you know.
And he never used a cookbook.
Never seen a cookbook in his house. But it was such a wonderful to assist him and to see how he goes about it, you know. And he would just talk while he did and put a little of this and a little of this and maybe this, and he would taste, constantly taste. And it was a show. His senses, all his senses were so overdeveloped. They were not normal, you know. He was super sensitive towards all the taste, his vision, you know, and in his pitch of hearing music, and that's all comes out in his work.
And how did he translate that super sensitivity into the ballet studio?
Oh, you know, it's funny. You felt when he would enter the studio, it's incredible. He could touch the air with energy. There was the energy about him. And then he was never forceful. He was very mother. He was very mother. Sensitive and caring. And you could see that. He would never raise his voice, you know. And he would say, instead of criticizing, he would say, maybe, dear, next time you can do it maybe this way or this way. He would make suggestions, but then he said, you are on stage, not I am. As he said, I can provide you with food, I can chew for you, but you have to digest it. And he trusted you, he knew you would.
Former ballerina Karin von Oldingen is vice chairman of the board of the George Balanchine Foundation, which preserves his work. And preserving the choreographer's legacy is the focus of a new exhibit at Harvard University called George Balanchine, A Life's Journey in Ballet. Among the photos, letters, and memorabilia on display, a letter Balanchine wrote in 1952 proposing to earn a little extra cash by marketing Vespa motorcycles in New York. The idea was rejected. Co-curator Iris Fanger spoke of her favorite item in the exhibit.
Well, I think I love the pictures of George Balanchine as a very young man in his 20s. He was very handsome and a real heartthrob, one might say, and certainly had his share of the ladies. But I think it's very touching to see him so young and so filled with self-assurance, but yet in a very strange new world. And that, for me, personifies the man.
The George Balanchine exhibit is at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts until May 28th. This week, the New York City Ballet opens its spring season. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
Join us again, Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
As the EU expands, we ask, how big is too big?